The Large Nerdron Collider podcast is a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Large Nerdron Collider podcast, the podcast that's all about the geeky things happening in the world around us and how very excited we are about them. I'm Ariel Kasten, and with me, as always, is the lovable Jonathan Strickland.
I want carnage.
That's so lovable, John.
Thank you. I'm just living up to the brand. Hey, Ariel.
Yes?
I've got a question for you. Okay, Ariel. You have been tapped to be part of a heist. What's your role on the team?
Oh, golly, Jonathan. Give a girl some warning. No, I think that I would be the pack mule.
So you're just like wearing cargo pants and like a fanny pack and one of those vests with all the pockets like Yelena was in Black Widow.
Yeah, because like I'm a little like I want to be super, super badass. So like I just started a D&D campaign and I'm playing a rogue and I'm like, man, I don't remember how to be a rogue. And if I can't even remember how to tabletop a rogue, I certainly couldn't be one in real life. So none of the sneaky stuff. I'm not very graceful. So none of like the dexterous stuff. And I get really anxious about being a lookout because I'm like, okay, do I leave? Do I tell you? What do I tell you? When do I tell you? I should stop looking away from my microphone when I'm talking. But so like... Yeah, the pack mule seems like the least stressful heist. Like, I'll carry all the gear.
I had you pegged as demolitions. I thought surely you were going to go demo.
That is a good option. I would not mind that. I'd probably injure myself. I once almost cut off my thumb trying to open a box with scissors. So,
yeah, that's probably not the best resume for going into high explosives.
Probably not. What about you?
I think I'd be a social engineer, like the kind of person who greases the wheels and distracts people and talks your way past stuff. So like in the Ocean's 11, yeah, kind of the face, but not necessarily the face. Like Matt Damon was kind of that. Like he was also the pickpocket mm-hmm. in Ocean's 11, but he was sort of a mm-hmm. social engineer type too. But yeah, that like it's a very big part of hacking. Like a lot of people think of hacking as sitting down at the computer and type it and you get in. But a lot about hacking typically is figuring out how to trick people into giving you access to systems mm-hmm. because that's way easier than forcing your way through a technical system. So that's kind of what I think my gig would be.
I think you'd be exceptional at that. So
I get by. I mean, I would get by.
You would get by. Wait.
Now, let's move on into the news stories. And our first one is one that we thought of because of our dear mutual friend, Shay. Hi, Shay. I know you listened to the show. And this was one that Ariel put down and included your name in it. Because you know your favorite film, Shay, The Exorcist? There's getting a sequel trilogy. Trilogy, Shay. Three movies.
Jonathan was so excited he could barely make that sentence.
Words failed me. I was possessed by an incoherent spirit. Yes. So for those who don't know, our friend Shay has a thing about demonic possession movies, and she really did not like The Exorcist. But yeah, we found
out. It's disturbing.
It is. And to be fair, like, have you seen, like, all three of the original Exorcist movies?
I've seen the first one, and I probably would have to piece it together because I covered my eyes for a good bit of it.
The first one is the masterpiece. The second one is almost unwatchable. And the third one is a very different movie, but I really love it. Genuinely, not ironically, I don't think it's a so bad it's good movie. I think it's legit a great movie. It's more like a thriller than a horror movie in some ways.
I might have to check the third one out then.
Phenomenal. Like there's some truly scary moments in it, but the interesting thing is it leaves that mostly up to your imagination. So it's not like mm-hmm. you're seeing gruesome things play out on screen, you're aware of what is happening and your imagination is filling in the gaps, and that's what makes it super creepy, right? Anyway,
yeah.
Great movie. And now we're going to get a sequel trilogy, and Ellen Burstyn, who was in The Original Exorcist, she's the mom, is coming back to play that same character in at least the first movie of that new trilogy.
Yeah. Also, Leslie Odom Jr. is going to be in it, which is awesome. He's a great actor, very talented. It's interesting to me, the article on Variety that we'll link to on our website, www.largeneutroncollider.com, mentions that Universal is spending $400 million to buy this trilogy, and Blumhouse is working on it, but Blumhouse got its start by doing cheap horror. So yeah.
They're low-budget horror that paid off big time.
Yeah, so, I mean, and they've done a lot, and it's progressively grown, and they've done, from what I understand, you know, I watch a lot of horror, they've done a good job with it, so I'm interested to see how this goes.
I would say that about half of what Blumhouse does in horror is really interesting, and about half of it is like, sure, we got the opportunity to do this. Why not even? But yeah. I mean, it's also keeping in mind that Blumhouse has done some projects with iHeart. Like there are some podcasts in that realm too. But yeah, I'm excited to learn more about this. From what we understand, Leslie Odom Jr. is playing a character whose daughter or whose child, I don't know if it's daughter, but his child has been possessed. And so he seeks out Ellen's character to get help because, of course, you know, Regan, the daughter in the original Exorcist movie was her daughter in that film.
Yeah.
And I guess what we're going to learn is that Leslie Odom Jr. was in the room where it happens when the possession takes place.
I mean,
I had to throw a Hamilton reference in.
Sure. Sure. No, it's fine. It's not a day if you don't hear at least one Hamilton reference. So I'm going to harken back to something we talked about a long time ago last week.
does feel and like whether, an eternity.
It does. And whether we would get any subsequent Dune media after the Dune movie. And guess what? We are.
But it's weird because it's not a sequel. It's not like we're getting one of the later Dune books. We're getting a prequel that could be loosely based on a kind of non-canon Dune novel.
Yes, it's called Dune the Sisterhood, and it is all about the Bene Gesserit.
Yeah, that's the order of women who are sort of the matriarchs of the society of the Dune universe. And they have sort of mystical powers. They're incredibly powerful women who intimidate the heck out of everybody they encounter for good reason.
Mm-hmm. And we don't have a whole lot other about that show. Now, I've caught your not being able to make sentences, Jonathan.
Sorry, we don't have a it whole is contagious.
It is. We don't have a lot of details on the show other than they have replaced one of the screenwriters, John Spatz? I can't even pronounce his name. With Diane Ademujohn. So
yeah. So a show we didn't know about until recently has replaced a writer we didn't know was writing on it with another writer is kind of the gist of that. But yeah, this will be it, like, I have high hopes for Dune. The trailer looked really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since it didn't really give the viewer much information about what the story of Dune is all about. Like, it kind of touches on it, but barely. So
if you know, then you'll know. But if you don't know,
right. Lost. I'm just thinking, like, if I had not read Dune, would I understand anything about what I saw in that trailer? And the answer is probably not, but it looks cool. So, yeah, I'm all for it.
Yeah. Something else that we don't know a lot about, but we're going to talk about anyhow, is that Lord of the Rings television show that we've mentioned a couple of times, because we finally got a first look, and the internet blew up at this first look, and it's pretty, But you really don't learn anything from it other than the fact that it's pretty.
Yeah, it's the by first look, we're talking about a single still image. And it shows a figure with a white cloak standing, with their back to you, the viewer. And in front of them is a white city and there are gleaming trees way off in the distance. And this is also like Sisterhood of Dune. This is a prequel series for Lord of the Rings. This happens thousands of years before the events of Lord of the Rings. And so this is like Silmarillion territory, pretty much. And we know that the show is going to come out in September of 2022.
And we know that it's going to be ultra expensive. They're going to have a boxing match between them and The Last of Us to figure out who's the most expensive TV show. But
I don't know why you want those bragging rights, but that seems to be a thing.
Yeah. I like the world that The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit is set around, but the Silmarillion is a dry read. So I hope this is a better watch than it was a read.
That's a kind way to put it. Well, a Silmarillion is really, it's a collection of stories and poems that lays out the earliest history of Middle Earth. And honestly, like I assume this is taking place in the First Age, but if it's taking place in the Second Age, well, then that's a lot of stuff that just doesn't even get covered in the Silmarillion. But we're going to now segue over to talk about one last thing before we end this section. And it's something I'm super excited about. We now know it opens in spring of next year. And that is the Star Wars Galactic Cruiser Hotel at Walt Disney World.
Yes, the spend an entire month's worth of your salary to go there hotel.
Yeah. They haven't announced, by the way. They haven't actually announced the prices, but that's probably a decent guess. Because my guess is that it's going to be similar to what you would have to spend for a cruise, because that's kind of how they're laying it out. Like, it is a cruise. And that you are cruising through space, your meals are all included with the fee, which is just like a cruise or most cruises. And you even have a shore excursion because you end up going to Galaxy's Edge over at Hollywood Studios, but they just refer to it as Batu. You're going to Batu. And I guess they're going to find a way of getting you in there where your exposure to the real world is kept to, you know, kind of as much of a minimum as they can manage so that they can preserve the storytelling experience.
I think they have sneaky, sneaky shuttles that will make it look like you're in a star shuttle, which it's Disney. They can do that. So here's the thing, because I LARP, and this is basically just a giant corporate LARP, right? In a galaxy that I would like to LARP in, I do want to go there. It's very expensive, so... I don't know if I'll be able to justify the expense. Last I heard, they were saying it was going to be like a couple thousand for a two-night excursion.
And that's what, like, this is set where it's not like you book a week to stay at the hotel. It is a two-night experience. So it's kind of like, and again, kind of like a cruise in that you have a specific limited amount of time that you're staying there. It's not like, oh, we are going 5 days at Walt Disney World, so we just went ahead and booked a room at the Galactic Cruiser.
Yeah, I mean, you can just chill out in your tracksuit if you want, but you can also dress up in costume, which is different from the Disney parks. In Disney parks, they don't really let you do that. But the thing is, so I've LARPed, right? And they're saying this is a giant hotel, so presumably there's going to be a ton of people staying there at any given two-day span. Mm-hmm. So... like the things I'm curious about are like, are you going to have overlapping 2 day spans? What is the limit on people? Do you have like a very specific time you have to check in? Because in LARPing, there's a lot of crowd control that you have to do. You can't bring 50 people on a secret covert little mission, you know, little module that you've set up, because only 4 people will get to interact with it. And the rest of the people will just have to stand there and stare. And that's not a lot of fun. So I wonder how they're going to allow each and every guest who's in there to have a personal experience with a module that they've set up. in any sort of meaningful way and still get the numbers that I expect they're going to be pulling through their doors.
Yeah. I don't know that either. I mean, it's hard to say what the capacity is going to be. They haven't really talked about that. But they did mention that there were a lot of challenges, but their job is to make those challenges disappear so that as a guest, you are unaware that those even exist, right? That you have a mm-hmm. seamless experience. And apparently there are multiple different types of experiences you can have. You can kind of pretend to be a Jedi. You could pretend to be like a smuggler. There's a lot of different opportunities. You can apparently, you know, maybe help the First Order, though I would really recommend against doing that. We've got enough First Order stuff in the world already. So, but I think that those are really cool ideas. And mm-hmm. what is really funny to me is that I'm a pretty big Star Wars fan, but it's my wife who really wants to go and do this, which really surprised me.
Really? Now, I could see her wanting to do it. It's a way to get the park experience without having to necessarily wake up early to do it.
Yeah, well, that's also true, is that part of this does involve going to the Galaxy's Edge park and getting to ride those rides. And presumably, if you're staying at the Galactic Cruiser, you probably have your own little entrance to some of these things mm-hmm. that will have you bypass waiting 3 hours in line to do it.
Yeah. Also, I will say, from the one time I went to Galaxy's Edge, which was lovely, the food was really good. And I expect that in this hotel, it'll be even better. So I would want to go simply to see how they imagineer the food alone.
Yeah, the pictures I've seen are, I mean, out of this world, I guess is a way of putting it. But like very showy, right? It's very much part mm-hmm. of the show. So yeah, we're very eager to learn more about it, especially like how much is this going to set you back? But again, it's not scheduled to open until spring of next year. So I'm guessing that they're going to be working out a lot more of the details and figuring that kind of stuff out, kind of figuring out what the market will bear. Also, the pandemic obviously is going to play a part in that. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know that I'll want to go right away until things calm down, yeah. but I'm very eager to see how that shakes out.
Me too. Well, something else that I was super eager about was He-Man, and that's why I watched all the way through it this past weekend. I mean, all 5 episodes. It was a huge time sink. But we touched on it a little bit last week, and we want to dive a little bit more into our thoughts on the show after this quick break.
Okay, Ariel, before we discuss the new show, did you ever watch like classic He-Man, the original cartoon?
I did. I watched classic He-Man. I didn't watch the 2003 reboot, but I heard it was, is it 2003? I think it's 2000. There was an early 2000s reboot of He-Man that actually has a very similar art style to this new one, so I think it inspired it a lot. But I watched the original. I did not watch, however, He-Man in Space. After we finished the series this weekend, my husband showed me the trailer for that, and it was upsettingly bad.
I didn't even know that was a thing. I did watch the original He-Man. I had way too many He-Man action figures as a kid, like tons of them, including ones that I don't think ever actually made an appearance in the original cartoon, but were marketed specifically as toys. They just never really showed up as cartoon characters.
I have Castle Eternia staring at me through my closet right now.
I had Eternia, and I also had Snake Mountain, and I also had a Swamp playset. I don't remember what the deal was with that. But yeah, like I was big into it as a kid. Mm-hmm. So what were your thoughts about the new one, the one that got like severely review bombed by a lot of fanboys out there?
So these are my thoughts. I can't guarantee no spoilers. So if you're really worried about spoilers for this show, you might want to skip ahead. So I thought that, one, I really enjoyed the story. It kept me on my toes and it kept me surprised at all points. The beginning where it focused on Teela felt a little bit incongruous for me just because I hadn't built up to that point. But then again, you know, if you since it's a continuation, if you go back to the original story of Teela being kind of a badass in the original He-Man, then it stands to reason that it starts off where it does. Honestly, the biggest complaint that I had about it was not that there wasn't a lot of He-Man or Skeletor, because there was honestly more He-Man and Skeletor than I anticipated in the five episodes. It was that sometimes when they really wanted to make a point apparent, they'd keep hitting on it, and then like the dialogue was a little bit cheesy around it, and then they'd hit on it again, and you're like, okay, I get the point. You're special.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Yeah, I agree. I think my issues are the same as yours. My expectations were really low too, because while I did love He-Man as a kid, as an adult, I recognize it was a cartoon designed to sell toys. It was a very thinly veiled commercial. It really wasn't there to tell any decent stories. And that this version is meant to appeal to the adults who watched it as kids. So there's only so much you can do before you change what it even feels like, right? Like if you went Quentin Tarantino with He-Man, then you're like, well, all these characters look like the characters from He-Man, but no one's acting like any of the characters from He-Man. Yeah. And granted, they did make some big change. Like Orko is a very different character in this one than he was in the original series. But, you know, it's one of those things where you do have these parameters you have to work in. And if you step outside of them, suddenly it's no longer the thing you were supposed to be making.
But part of it was, just a lot of fun to watch from a casting side standpoint as well, in the different people that they cast in the roles. Teela is Sarah Michelle Gellar, who is Buffy from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Mossman was Alan Oppenheimer, who was the original voice of Skeletor and like a bazillion other characters on He-Man. So I like that they were able to do that. And Orko, even though he was different, I still absolutely adored him, was voiced by the guy who played Arthur in the new Tick series, Griffin something something.
Interesting. Well, the reason why we wanted to bring this up is that obviously it plays into that fan response where there were a lot of people who were upset at the direction of the show, and they made that extremely well known by review bombing. Like it was a thing where the scores, the Rotten Tomatoes scores, when we reported on this, the critical score was in the 90 percentile and the audience score was in the 30 percentile. And it really was just indicative of all these fans. And like, if you search on YouTube for reactions to this, you'll see some of the most toxic videos you've ever seen. Ripping the show to shreds. And I get the idea of having your expectations subverted where you thought you're going to be watching a He-Man cartoon, and it's not, it's called Masters of the Universe. So there you can argue, well, it's really about this collection of characters, not just one. But you can make that argument, but even so, the fifth episode kind of makes it clear that there's a lot more story to tell.
And
you just have to be patient to get to it.
Yeah. So I will admit that at times, big, big spoiler. Most of the time that you see He-Man, he's actually Prince Adam in this show. And Prince Adam's a little bit of a doof, you know, and I had to remember that, you know, that's how he was in the original cartoon. But like the way that he plays in the story as Prince Adam is very powerful. And I think it's actually a really great message to like friendship and where you find your worth as a person. So I actually quite liked it. I thought they were a little clunky in voicing it. They're a little ham-fisted. That's a good one. But I liked the concept behind it quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, and this kind of also leads into a discussion that I wanted to have, a little bit of one. I mean, this is a topic that's so big that it could easily take a full hour to really dive into. But it's this odd aspect of fandom that I frequently find off-putting. Like, I've been around fandom since I was a small child. I'm 46 now. I've been in various fandoms for more than 40 years at this point, because my parents write science fiction and fantasy. I've been going to conventions since I was a little kid. I've been around other creators of those genres, as well as other fans of those genres. So I've been part of the fandom experience for most of my life, almost all of my life. And the good parts are great, like getting together with people and celebrating something you love. There is something magical about that. It felt like back in the pre-internet days, things like conventions were, that was how you did it, right? Because you might not have anyone else in your area who even watches, say, like Star Trek or Doctor Who. But you go to a convention and now everybody knows what you're talking about. You get all excited and you have these great conversations, you make friends. Like, it was a really special thing. But on the flip side, fans can get a sense of ownership about things that they love. Mm-hmm. And then if something doesn't go the way they wanted it to go, they can turn super vicious. And we see this in lots of aspects of fandom, from gatekeeping, like cosplay gatekeepers are some of the worst.
Yeah,
where they're like, oh no, you can't be so-and-so because of such and such reason. And like, it's just, that's just nasty.
You can be an alligator Loki if you want.
Yeah, totally. Did you see, like, so LeVar Burton's daughter, Mika Burton, who is a phenomenal cosplayer, went Disney bounding, and her Disney bounding was a black dress and a Loki headdress. And she said that it was the best experience because now that there are Loki variants, like now they're essentially variants of every Marvel thing, that is open license for anyone to cosplay as anybody, which I think is fantastic.
Me too.
Right?
Me too.
But yeah, this is one of those things about fandom that I find it doesn't sit well with me, and it makes me less willing to engage in fandom because I recognize these sorts of behaviors as being at best unwelcoming and at worst like outright toxic.
I agree. It's part of the reason why I think we get so much media that repeats itself instead of new stories or things like that, or continuations, like a continuation of He-Man. You just get a bunch of reboots instead that don't actually reimagine much because creators are afraid of getting panned. They'd rather have the surefire win. And I wish people would have a bit more of an open mind.
That's an excellent point, Ariel, because that's one of the other things we observe, right? Is that pleasing the fan base becomes incredibly difficult because the fans want more of whatever it was they loved. If you make it too much like the thing they loved, then they'll just say, well, this is just the same thing, and they get upset at you. If you change too many things, they say, this isn't what I loved anymore, and they get upset at you. So it's really hard to walk that line. It's one of the reasons why when I hear about like a sequel to something, even if it's something that's been over for decades, like The Exorcist, or like Ghostbusters, because 2016 never happened. Then
I didn't hate it. It was just scripted comedy as opposed to improvised, and therefore it didn't feel as genuine or as funny. But I didn't hate it.
I just felt like it was just not the it just didn't wasn't the right humor for me. Not saying it was bad. It was not the right humor for me.
Okay, back on track.
That's more on me, not on the movie. Anyway. Yeah, like it means that you're painted into a corner, right? Like it's why I would tend to prefer something new, which obviously is a risk because you don't know if it's ever going to perform well, rather than see someone try and reinvent the same thing for the 40th time and potentially alienate the fan base that made that thing popular in the first place. I am so glad I don't have to make those decisions, that I'm not the one making these kinds of films or series, but it's tough. Like one of the negatives about the fandom base. It's that they are incredibly fickle. Yeah. And if you displease them, they are not shy at all about voicing their displeasure.
Not at all. Where do you fall on things like Agatha Christie or Poirot or Knives Out, where it's not the same story, but it's the same universe?
Well, I mean,
sequels.
I don't necessarily object to it. Like, I actually really like reimaginings when I think there also is an element of time at play where if it's long enough, then you might have a cultural awareness of the property, but you might not be as familiar with the original material because while you know of it because there are references all around you, you may not have actually seen it. So as an example, like there are some classic films I haven't seen. I still to this day have never seen Casablanca, but I recognize Casablanca references because those quotes are everywhere. They're inescapable. Mm-hmm. But in those cases, I think there's enough distance for most people that it's kind of a non-factor. And for things that kind of play in, and you might think of them as almost like a pastiche or like copying the style of something that came before, if it's done well, I can find it really entertaining. Like Knives Out, like I still think Knives Out was just a really fun time at the movies. Not that I was really surprised. Like I pegged who it was at the very beginning of the movie. And then I was like, oh, so the person I thought did it. But otherwise it was really fun.
But you know, I don't know how I feel about the sequel because are they going to lean too heavily on the things that the people like in the first one? Or is it going to be a completely new mystery?
Well, I mean, Columbo was around forever.
Yeah.
And like the thing about Columbo was that like that performance, Peter Falk's performance really made that show special. So I'm going to hope that they'd pull a Columbo and we get something similar out of that.
Me too.
Well, when we come back, like obviously we could talk about this forever. I mean, there are so many different things this touches upon in the world of fandom. And I don't mean to say that all fandom is bad, but rather fandom frequently comes with it some baggage that, that I find unsettling. But when we come back, we're going to really unsettle things by mashing up two things that never, ever should come in contact with one another. All right, Ariel, let's talk about the little news stories in brief that inspired the mashup we're going to do today. One is that over this past week, we got a new trailer for the new Venom movie, the Venom Carnage film.
Yes.
What did you think of the trailer?
I liked the first Carnage trailer. I like the second one, too. It makes me excited to watch it, which is saying something because I only very recently watched the first Venom. I thought I was going to hate it. I thought it was not going to be a good movie, and I absolutely loved it. The second one looks really good. It looks darker than the first, maybe a little bit more gory than the first, but Woody Harrelson makes a really good serial killer.
He's had some practice. He's played it before.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I was just like getting natural born killer vibes as I was watching it.
Mm-hmm.
A reference, a throwback. I don't care about Venom. I wish I could match your enthusiasm, but I could take it or leave it. I watched it and I was like, I feel nothing. I'm the next sociopathic killer in the Venom universe.
Maybe you've just got a symbiote in you.
Could be. And the other element that we are going to use in our mashup is Buffy the Vampire Slayer, because we recently learned there's going to be a young adult series, a trilogy of novels that take place many years after the events of the TV series Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yes, it's going to be Willow, who is Buffy's good friend and witch, Willow's daughter, who becomes a slayer.
Frankie.
Frankie.
Yeah, she's a witch and a slayer at the same time, so watch out.
Yeah, Disney's excited to dive into their giant catalog of other properties they've acquired, and they're doing this one via book form. So we'll see how it
right.
goes.
So we're going to do a mashup of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Venom. And in case you're not familiar with either of these things, here's a quick summary. Venom is an alien symbiote, an alien life form that needs to have a host, thus the symbiotic relationship. And in the Marvel comics, he's related to, or he's associated with Spider-Man. But in the movie, they remove that association, and he inhabits the body of a guy named Eddie Brock, who's a journalist. And Eddie Brock is just a normal guy, but he gets essentially superpowers with the symbiote that also is kind of a raging psycho. And then Buffy the Vampire Slayer is a series about a young woman named Buffy who inherits the powers of vampire slayers, which are kind of this magical power that passes through women throughout history. And it's her job to kill bad demons and vampires and stuff. And she's mm-hmm. got friends like Xander and Willow, and she's got a watcher named Giles, and they try to fight evil. And
she
falls in
love with a lot of vampires.
She does. She has a thing for vampires, you know, the things that she's supposed to be slaying. She does have a little thing for them. All right. So with that in mind, we now have it set up. Would you like to go first or shall I?
Do you have a preference?
I'll go first. Mine's not funny. Mine feels like a Buffy the Vampire Slayer episode.
Well, I'm excited about it. So go ahead and go.
This is called You Got Venom on My Buffy. Xander Harris has a problem. His job as a construction worker and carpenter has hit a bit of a slow streak, with seemingly fewer folks eager to build upon a hellmouth. And so, in order to make ends meet, he answers an ad from a company called The Life Corporation. He agrees to take part in some secretive clinical trials in return for some cash. Boom. Opening credits. What Xander doesn't know is that the Life Corporation has a few samples of a symbiotic life form found after a Life Corporation space probe passed through a comet. These symbiotes need a host, and Xander unknowingly becomes one of them. Meanwhile, back at the Scooby Gang Clubhouse, aka Rupert Giles's apartment, Buffy, Willow, and Giles are hanging out. And Buffy is enjoying some downtime because it's actually been pretty quiet in Sunnydale, California lately. Giles, of course, is nervous, assuming that the next catastrophe is right around the corner, and Willow is adorably awkward and dorky. The scene is cute and all, but it doesn't, you know, really move things along very much. Then we cut to that night, when Xander is back home. He's trying to get some sleep, but he feels restless, and he's tossing, and he's turning a bit, and then he yelps in pain, he sits up quickly, turns on a light, and he sees that, for a moment, he has this weird black substance all over his leg that just then disappears. We cut outside of Xander's house to an unmarked van where a pair of somewhat sinister men wearing Life Corporation jackets keep Xander's house under observation. Then we go to commercial. When we're back, it's daytime and Xander is heading to meet up with Buffy and Willow to go see a movie. Let's say it's American Psycho, because that film's release lines up with the season in which Xander's a construction worker, so why not? But on his way, he has to slam on the brakes in his car because this guy just runs right out in front of him, and then the guy then fumbles with a handgun and points it at Xander through the windshield and demands that Xander get out of the car. So Xander, flipping out, says, all right, don't shoot, and he does his best to get out of the car. He's obviously panicking. The would-be carjacker runs around to the car door, and Xander does a bunch of dumb things like forgetting to unbuckle his seatbelt before trying to get out, and he's actually removing his keys from the car as if he were parking it, and the guy, frustrated, clicks back the hammer of the gun, and then it happens. Xander transforms in the blink of an eye into an 8-foot-tall, hulking, dark form, and the guy, freaking out, fires his gun, but the bullets seem to have no effect on this monster. And next thing you know, the Xander symbiote, whom we'll just go ahead and say it's Venom, chomps down on the guy, though we don't actually see that happen because this is a TV show and there are various, you know, restrictions and stuff. The symbiote retreats into Xander, who is left incoherently babbling at what has just happened as he hears police sirens. Thinking quickly, he gets back in his car and he waits. The cops show up, clearly in pursuit of the would-be carjacker, and they are astounded at what they find. But Xander doesn't have a drop of blood on him. And he does his best to explain he was just driving when this guy ran in front of his car, and he has no idea what happened next. And hey, this is Sunnydale. People get decapitated alarmingly frequently there. Commercial break. We come back and we see Xander meeting up with Willow and Buffy, who are irritated because he didn't make it to the movie in time, and also they say they didn't like the movie very much. But Xander is totally out of it. When he speaks, it's as if he's talking to someone else that only he can hear. And Buffy and Willow find that strange, but not strange enough to actually pursue this further because it's a TV show and we still have some commercials to get through. What follows is Xander learning about the symbiote, which does call itself Venom, and the fact that the symbiote is really powerful. But the symbiote also really wants to bring the rest of its own kind down to Earth to, you know, wreak havoc and infect everyone and make it their new home. So Xander feels a little conflicted. On the one hand, superpowers are kind of awesome, and now he knows how Buffy feels. But on the other, the symbiote feels, at best, really amoral, and at worst, downright evil. So, of course, he decides to keep it all a secret. Xander then starts going on patrols all by himself, not telling the others. And doing so, he manages to take out some of Sunnydale's minor nasties, like relatively young vampires and such, which both makes him feel more valuable, and it satisfies the huge, hungry symbiote, until one night, he doesn't realize he's being watched by a watcher. That's Giles. The next day, Giles calls a meeting with the Scoobs and explains what he saw. Xander, recognizing exactly what Giles is talking about, does his best to derail the conversation or suggest that the monster maybe is a good guy. But Giles' description pretty much convinces Willow and Buffy that this monster is not good news. Xander decides he needs to lie low, but Venom has other ideas. And then we go to a commercial break. But when we're back, we see Xander walking alone, arguing with himself. Really, he's arguing with Venom, but to anyone else, it looks like he's just yelling at himself. And then Venom just takes over and starts going on a rampage. It's carnage. Not literally, but you know what I mean. We obviously ramp up to a confrontation between Venom and Buffy, who puts up an incredible fight, but it looks like Venom might actually get the best of her. Xander manages to wrest control from Venom, though, and prevents the symbiote from delivering a killing blow. Then he looks at Buffy and says, "Help!" Buffy, Giles, and Willow manage to restrain Xander, and then through a crazy ritual led by Willow, they manage to exorcise the symbiote and capture it in a glass jar, which Giles stores away for safekeeping. Except, we see that a pair of looky-loos, those two mysterious men from the Life Corporation, are observing from afar, and sitting in a van behind them is Spike with an evil grin on his face. Cut to credits.
I love it. That really does feel like a Buffy episode, like shot for shot.
Yeah.
Well done.
No, I've watched a lot of Buffy. Every single episode, in fact.
Probably a few times. So in my version, one thing we didn't mention is sometimes Venom is a bad guy, and then sometimes he's an anti-hero. And
yes.
So this is a little bit more after when he's become an anti-hero, kind of similar to the movie, but not 100% in line with their history. Okay, so this is called Vemmy the Vampire Slayer. It was one of those classic roommate situations. Venom and Eddie Brock had lived together so long, every little thing they did got on each other's nerves. Venom would leave chicken bones around for Eddie to step on. Eddie wouldn't let Venom eat people. Venom would leave bits of symbiote all over the toilet seat. Mm. Eddie wouldn't let Venom eat people. Venom would eat people, and Eddie would pout about it. And the list goes on and on. Well, one day Venom had had enough. He decided the situation had to change, so while Eddie was asleep, Venom left to find a new host. He was lurking in some shadows when he came across a brooding dark figure. I guess Venom has a type. Well, he decided to jump into that brooding dark figure, and when he did, he found himself in an internal fight between good and evil. Thankfully, that internal fight wasn't eternal, and soon he had control of a one Angel, Angelus, Liam, something, something, I don't know. His history is really confusing, and Venom didn't have enough time to sort it out. And Venom felt powerful. He was about to go off and explore this newfound union when a small blonde figure threw her arms around Angel's body and kissed him. I guess Venom's types have types. Well, Venom was intrigued, and so he let Angel take the wheel. "No, Buffy, you don't understand," Angel screamed. "There's something dark inside of me, you have to go." And Buffy said, yeah, I've heard that before. If you don't like me, just say so." And she kicked Angel across the room. Well, Venom wouldn't have that. He took over and cartoon arm punched Buffy through a wall. Venom thought, yay, snack time. But the little blonde one, Buffy, got up out of the wall, barely phased, and began to kick Venom's butt. How could this be, Venom thought. She must have a symbiote herself, and he stuck a Venom tendril in her ear. Nope, no symbiote, but wowie kapowie, if Venom thought he had power in this Angel dude, it was double that with this Buffy girl. Like a battery of kick buttitude. He jumped ship to this new host and promptly slayed Angel. And then ate him. And he was tasty. Then Venom went on a rampage through California looking for more bumpy-headed idiots to slay and eat. Buffy wasn't sure what was going on, but this wasn't the normal evil she always encountered, so she let it ride to see its game. And it turns out Venom was really helpful. I mean, he didn't like staking vampires because he didn't like his steak well done, but he was really effective at keeping her from getting her normal bumped and bruised up. So they slayed a while together, usually killing monsters, occasionally symbiotes in monsters, because word got around about what a fun ride that was, until one day Buffy looked in the mirror and said, "We have to have a talk." Venom popped his head out and said, "What's up, Buttercup?" But he knew. Buffy was about to say she loved him. He said, "This is a working relationship, Toots," and popped back inside. And then Buffy pouted. She pouted like Venom had never experienced pouting before. It was unbearable. And it made Venom miss home. Well, Eddie. And all of his annoying little habits. So while Buffy slept, Venom jumped ship once more and went back to Eddie. And before sneaking back into his cozy little corner of Eddie's consciousness, he picked up a couple chicken bones off the floor. And they all lived happily ever after.
I love it.
Thank you.
There was so much Buffyisms in there with the kick buttitude and such.
Yay!
Also, just quick shout out to the original Buffy the Vampire Slayer film, just because Paul Reubens in that movie, like, that movie's not necessarily good, but Paul Reubens in that movie is, my favorite line is from him, where it's, "You ripped my jacket. Kill him a lot." Which I think is just great. It's a great line.
Well, it is. Buffy had a way of taking, like, language and just turning it slightly on its ear in a valley sort of a way. And I love
it. Yeah. Well, and the response I often heard about Buffy the Vampire Slayer is, it's a show in which teenagers speak in a way that real teenagers never do, but you always kind of wish that that's how they talked. Mm-hmm. Like, they had, like, these very clever ways, not necessarily like deep references all the time, but they have very clever responses to one another, which is one of the things that made the show really enjoyable. Don't know what's up with the Buffy reboot that's supposed to come out. I don't know if that's still a thing or not. Obviously the pandemic, I'm sure, put like major wrenches in that works, but it's something I wouldn't mind seeing a new take on. And of course, with the stuff we've learned about Joss Whedon in the years since, seeing a take on it that is kind of divorced from him would probably be for the best, too.
I agree.
Yeah. Well, that's it for this episode. If you have things you would like to share with us, maybe you have your own mashup that you would love to pitch to us. Maybe you have ideas for mashups that you think would be a lot of fun. You can get in touch with us. One way is to send us email. The email address is lnc@iheartmedia.com. Or you can reach out on the various socials. Take it, Ariel.
On Twitter, we are LNC_podcast. And on Facebook and Instagram, we're a large Nerdron Collider. Please do write us. We love talking with you. If you've written us and it took us a while to write back, we're sorry. We'll be better about that. And also, we loved just having that conversation, so we hope to hear from you. Please tell your friends if you like us. Subscribe, share, all of that good, happy, fun stuff. That way, we have more wonderful people to talk to.
And until next time, I'm Jonathan, the Chosen One Strickland.
And I am Ariel Symbiote Cast.
The Large Nerdron Collider is a production of iHeartRadio and was created by Ariel Kasten. Jonathan Strickland is the executive producer. The show is produced, edited, and published by Tari Harrison. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.